Hello, everybody, and welcome to another beautiful Thursday morning. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And I have another great show for all of you today. My guest today will be Dr. John Todd. He's one of the pioneers in the field of ecological design, and he has a new book called Healing Earth. And I'll tell you more about him when he comes on in just a little bit. But first, I want to share with you some things that are in the news. And actually, there's some good things in the news as well, which is always an unusual thing these days. We finally got a delay in the Keystone Pipeline. The Keystone Pipeline has been an ongoing issue for many, many years. That is the pipeline that is supposed to take the tar sands from up in the western part of Canada all the way down through the indigenous plains in the Midwest, all the way down to the Gulf of Mexico. And this is crude oil, disgusting tar sands oil that they are supposed, that they are trying to export from Canada into and out of the Gulf of Mexico, all for export. It's not even for our use. It's really for export, purely for the profit of TransCanada. And it is just bad news. Pipelines always leak. As much as they like to say that they're safe, they leak, there are problems. And the bottom line is we need to get away from fossil fuels and go towards renewable energy. We all know that. So putting more money into infrastructure to continue our dependence on fossil fuels just doesn't make sense. So I'm really happy to report that federal judges just this week have banned the company from pre-construction while pending another environmental review. So that's really great news. Another really positive thing is in New York State, and hopefully more states will follow, New York State passed a bill to ban Dow's toxic brain-damaging pesticide chlorpyrifos. And chlorpyrifos has also been in the news for years. It's adding to bee claps, which we've all heard about. And it's just really bad. You know, along with Roundup that we've been hearing, winning lawsuits. It's just, you know, finally getting the recognition it needs and getting banned. So that's really a wonderful thing, and I'm really happy about that. Some things that I wrote about as far as taking action goes, I want to let you know that NOFA New York, which is the Northeast Organic Farming Association, which I am a member of and a board member of, they are in need of funds. And so we will be having a gala on August 23rd. But even before that, if you're not a member of the Northeast Organic Farming Association and you care about organic food, this is an organization you really want to support. So please go to nofanewyork.org and consider donating. We are having our gala on August 23rd. We are looking for silent auction items and bigger live auction items as well. So if you have any ideas, please reach out to me at Bhavani at IE Green. This Saturday is the 27th annual Stamp Out Hunger Food Drive, 27 years. And this is, you know, something that the nation's post office does. And what you can do is on Saturday morning, put out non-perishable items by your mailbox, and your mail carrier will pick them up. And our local About Hunger will be supporting Island Harvest, which is a wonderful food bank here on Long Island. They need our support as well. You know, even though Long Island is thought of as being very affluent, there are so many hungry people right here that are our neighbors, and we have no idea about it. So, and Island Harvest is actually looking for volunteers to help sort the food that they get as well. So if you have any time availability on Monday or Tuesday of next week, when they get all that food, they are looking for volunteers as well. And you can just reach out to Island Harvest on their website for that. I believe I have a link on my website as well. We've all been hearing about antibiotic resistance that is spreading, and it's all due to, or partially due to, the overuse of antibiotics in agriculture. And the Centers for Disease Control has labeled antibiotic resistance as one of the world's most pressing public health problems. And it is really a problem. We're hearing about more and more infections that antibiotics just are not able to cure. And so there's a link on my website to tell the EPA and Congress to save antibiotics for when we really need them and to eliminate them in as pesticides. So please log on to my website at iegreen.com and sign that petition along with a petition for the Williams Pipeline. I've been writing about this also for weeks. It's really up to Governor Cuomo at this point to not permit the permit for the Williams Pipeline. And this is a pipeline that would be taking taking the fracked gas from Pennsylvania through New Jersey into New York Harbor, past Staten Island. And again, you know, to build, they're hoping to build a fracked gas facility right in New York Harbor by Long Island. And so that is also bad because, yes, we do know that they leak. The risks and the damage that they could cause are just unbelievable. And with the millions and millions of people that live right here in the New York area, it's just ridiculous to even consider it. So please sign that petition as well. And what else did I want to tell you about? There's so many great things. This past weekend was the Women's Diversity Summit, which happened at SUNY Old Westbury. This is their second annual summit. And the Women's Diversity Network is a new startup. This is their second year, bringing women together of diverse backgrounds to really try to solve some of the problems here on Long Island, one of them being social justice and racial issues to start with. Like I mentioned before, the disparity on Long Island is just huge. And we have very wealthy people living right next to people that do not have enough food. And it's just unacceptable. And so the Women's Diversity Network is bringing people together. It was a whole day of workshops. And it was really wonderful to be there and provide some healthy vegan and gluten-free food for the people that were there. So that was wonderful. Some things coming up that you may want to participate in, starting with, starting with tonight. Tonight, the River Fund, which is the organization that I cook for the homeless for Thanksgiving and Christmas, they're having their spring shindig. It's at the Bay Room in Manhattan on Liberty Street. I'm sorry, excuse me. Tickets, it's cocktails and hors d'oeuvres. Tickets are $200 for two people. And you can buy some tickets at the door. Or you can go to the riverfund.org website and get the tickets there. And then on May 22nd, Slow Food North Shore, which is the organization that I am affiliated with, we are having a farm gathering at the Elijah Farm, which is a farm in South Huntington that works with young adults on the spectrum. And it's a wonderful place. They have a CSA, a community supported agricultural program there. They do cooking workshops. They're doing so many great things. And so there's going to be a farm tour, a slow food screening, and it is a potluck. We're asking people to bring their own dishes because it's an eco-friendly event. So if you can make it to that, that would really be great. Also on May 23rd, there's a food waste fair. And this is a interactive experience, connecting you with resources and knowledge to help you get to zero food waste. And this should be really an interesting event. I have not gone to it before, but I'm looking forward to it. And you can go to the website at foodwastefair.nyc to find out more information about that. And as I already said, the NOFA Gala is coming up August 23rd. And Slow Food Nations is happening July 19th to the 22nd. That's in Denver. And that's a huge slow food festival. They take over the whole city of Denver. There's parties, outdoor barbecues, picnics, everything going on all around the city, as well as great conferences and workshops talking about food waste, talking about diversity, talking about so many issues that are really, really important. So if you can make it to that, that would be really wonderful. And now I'd like to share with you my recipe. Every week I share a recipe with you. And even though I am a chef, I still need to put dinner on the table every night. And I'm not always inspired to come up with a new, exciting recipe. A lot of times I'm just looking through my refrigerator. It's okay, what do I have here? And so I want to incorporate leftovers. I really try to use things up so that I'm not wasting food. So I had some of the cold sesame noodles left, although not the sesame, but just the noodles, the organic brown rice noodles left from the weekend's event in my refrigerator. So I decided I need to use them up. And I actually harvested collard greens and asparagus from my garden. And I'm really excited about that. This is my first year harvesting my asparagus. I've been waiting 3 years to finally be able to pick them. And so that is really exciting. So I had some asparagus and I had collard greens. And of course, asparagus are prolific in the markets right now. This is their time. So you can really get great asparagus in the market. So this is a spring pasta with butter beans. I wanted some protein in there. So I had a can of butter beans, which are those large white lima bean looking things. And they're just so delicious. So I started with 1/4 cup of olive oil in my wok. I sliced up one onion into crescent moons. I used 2 tablespoons of chopped garlic and 2 tablespoons of minced ginger. 2 carrots that I cut into julienne strips. My 2 cups of collard greens, and I also had 2 cups of asparagus. And I like cutting the asparagus on an angle. It just brings out the flavor, and they just look so pretty that way. I also cut, I had some assorted peppers. I used a couple different colors. I had a yellow, orange, and a red one. So I used 1 cup of julienne sliced assorted peppers, 1/4 cup of water, 2 tablespoons of aji marin. That's a sweet rice wine. And when you're buying that, you need to be careful. Kikkoman brand, which makes soy sauce, they make an aji marin. But if you look at the ingredients, it's glucose syrup. It is not mirin. Mirin is made from sweet rice wine and seaweed. So look at the ingredients and do not buy the Kikkoman brand. 3 tablespoons of tamari, which is a gluten-free soy sauce. 1 tablespoon of dark sesame oil. One teaspoon of hot sesame oil, and that you can adjust depending on your taste. You can either leave it out or you can add more if you like it a little spicier. I used 1 can of organic butter beans. I used 2 cups of my already cooked pasta. So that's up to you. I really wanted it to be mostly vegetables, so I only put 2 cups of pasta in. But that's up to you. And then I also added 1/4 cup of chopped cilantro. And cilantro, as you know, some people love it, some people don't. If you don't like it, you can substitute regular parsley for that. So I started by sauteing the onions in the wok for about 5 minutes. Then I added the ginger and the garlic. I snapped off the bottom of the asparagus spears because that's the tough part. If you just bend them, they'll automatically snap where the toughness starts. So you can then discard the ends or save them for a stock. And then I sliced up the rest of it into about 2-inch size pieces. Then I added the carrots to the onions. I cooked that for about 3 minutes. Then I added the collard greens. And at this point, it started to stick. I didn't want to add any more oil, so I added that 1/4 cup of water at that point. And I continued sauteing the collards until they got bright green color and started softening. Then I added the asparagus and the peppers and just cooked for a few more minutes. Added the mirin and the tamari, and that also helped deglaze the pan and steam the rest of the vegetables so that they cooked a little faster. Then I added the beans and the pasta, and I mixed that well, and I cooked it really just till the pasta got hot. Rice noodles, when they're refrigerated, they get really hard in the refrigerator, and so you can't really eat a cold rice pasta salad unless you make it and just run it under cold water and eat it like room temperature. But once it's been in the refrigerator, you really need to reheat it to make it edible. So I was just tossing the vegetables with the pasta until that got soft and hot. Then I added the dark sesame oil and the hot sesame oil. And sesame oil is really used as a seasoning at this point. I'm not using it for cooking. It gives that Asian flavor to the stir fry. And then just at the last minute, I added the cilantro, and that is it. It was absolutely delicious, and I recommend you all making it. And as always, I love feedback on my dishes. So if you do make a dish, send me a little message at bhavani@iegreen and let me know how you liked it. And now it's my pleasure to introduce to all of you my guest, Dr. John Todd. As I mentioned before, he's one of the pioneers of the in the field of ecological design and author of a new book called Healing Earth. John did his undergraduate work at McGill University in agriculture and parasitology, and then he got his PhD at the University of Michigan in fisheries and oceanography. He is an emeritus research professor and distinguished lecturer at the University of Vermont, and a fellow at the Gund Institute for Ecological Economics. He's the founder and president of John Todd Ecological Design and president of Ocean Arcs International, which is an NGO dedicated to publishing and to healing the inshore oceans. He's based in Woods Hole, Massachusetts. Dr. Todd is also has also published over 200 scientific, technical, and popular articles. He's the author or co-author of 7 other books and is the inventor of Eco Machines, and I'll let him tell us more about that. John, are you with me?
I am with you. Good morning. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you so much for taking the time and joining us. I'm really excited to have this conversation.
It's my pleasure.
With you.
I must say you've made me hungry. I haven't had breakfast yet, and you're
good.
Narrating that recipe.
Good. Well,
oh well.
Come on down to my place anytime, and I love feeding people, so maybe I'll make it for you. Anyway, I just want to ask you if you could tell us a little bit about your background before we go into why you wrote the book, Healing Earth.
Mm-hmm. I have kind of an eclectic background. I started out because I had read these visionary writings of the author Louis Bromfield, who used agriculture as a way of healing landscapes. And so I said to myself, well, I think I want to do that too, so I'm going to study agriculture. And I did, and I found that it was not the field that Louis Bromfield was writing about. It was more about chemicals, input-output analysis. It was kind of a cold-blooded discipline. Mm-hmm. But at that time, I had a couple of wonderful professors. One was a soil scientist from Scotland, and another was an evolutionary biologist from New Zealand. And I just got caught on fire by peering into this diversity of life and evolution and the life story, really. I mean, I wasn't a terribly disciplined guy. I liked so many things. But then I went on to study parasitology and tropical medicine, and my professor there had done pioneering work on malaria in the South Pacific, and he got me all fired up about being able to do research in the wild and learn about problems and how to solve them in the wild, and so that was a great introduction. And when I went on to do my doctorate at the University of Michigan, I had this, again, it's connecting with brilliant people, and I connected with a professor called John Bardock, and he had lived a very colorful and in some cases dangerous life through World War II. But he just saw the whole world kind of as his beat and encouraged his graduate students to do the same thing. So before I knew it, I was becoming more of a biological explorer than a, you know, than an employable scientist.
Uh-huh.
That's how it all began, and I got to go to some very romantic places and do good work, and ended up here in Woods Hole as a on the Massachusetts coast of Cape Cod, where I became, I worked as an oceanographer and was studying the private lives of marine creatures, mostly fishes, but not just entirely fishes. So, and then after that, with my wife, Nancy Jack Todd, and a good friend, we created this institute called the New Alchemy Institute. And our reason for doing that was we wanted to dream in a very large way, and we made our slogan for the institute to restore the lands, to protect the seas, and to inform the earth stewards. And the three of us have been working at it ever since, as well as having a wonderful bunch of colleagues. So the story of being a steward.
Now, when was that? Was that
1969? The New Alchemy Institute was formed in 1969, but we brought it to Cape Cod in 1971, where we acquired a farm and really settled down to work. Prior to that, it was in its what you would call the coffee shop stage, all talk and no action. And then we shifted from all action and less talk.
Well, your new book is really exciting to me, because I think I hear so often, especially amongst climate change deniers, that we don't really have to do anything. You know, they're just kind of waiting around for people to come up with innovative ideas of how they can solve the problems rather than really make change. And I think we really need to attack this climate change situation from both sides. And you really talk about some innovative ideas in this book. And I'd love to talk about it. So can you tell us a little bit about Healing Earth? What inspired you to write it?
Yes.
And is it more of a memoir or more of a manual?
Well, it's three things. It's a memoir, because I've had some interesting experiences, and it's a manual. It introduces people to the idea that nature has a vocabulary, and that vocabulary has a story to tell. And then thirdly, and this is important, and I'll elaborate on this for just a tiny bit, it's also a call to the young and the young of heart to dedicate themselves to the task of healing the planet. And I outline ways in which people who are quite removed normally from nature can get involved. And so that my goal is to really inspire a movement. And when I saw earlier this spring the young people, you know, protesting the lack of action, that was the group of people that I hope would read Healing Earth. Now, the reason for writing the book, because as I say, as you said, I have written a number of books, was out of a sense of urgency. When I was a professor at the University of Vermont, and I taught the upper classes ecological design, I realized at the very beginning that the students, very bright, knew a lot about the world, but what they mostly knew about their world from their environmental studies and natural resource studies was what's wrong. They were experts on what's wrong in the world. And too many of them, in my view, were paralyzed, even depressed by their knowledge. So with my class, I said, we're going to turn this around. We're going to make people engage. We're going to fill this classroom with mottos like do good things in bad places. You know, tackle problems directly head on and see if there are solutions that we can even do in our greenhouse laboratory. And it was a real turnaround, and so many of them became engaged, and so many organizations and entities started to be created by them that were hands-on. Many of them became farmers, and really good farmers, the kind that you were talking about, NOFA. And many of them did kind of environmentally related theater, some really brilliant stuff, just all kinds of things. Others became healers of damaged environments and so on. So it when I stood one day in class, and I can't remember which year it was, I said, I would like to start to create something that could employ all of these people and all of these people every year. I haven't got there yet, but I'm sure working on it.
Wow, that's great. That's great, because, you know, that's one of the concerns. I think there are so many people now getting degrees in environmental science and environmental entrepreneurship and sustainability, but then they go out and finding jobs where they can really use some of their creative ideas is a challenge.
Yes, and there are certain projects that are beginning to gain steam that will, for example, there's Holland is an epicenter for a lot of creativity in this field. And within the last few years, a foundation was created called Common Lands. And you can just Google that and put a .nl at the back of it. And their plan is literally to create these towns or camps or whatever throughout some of the arid regions of Southern Europe and Northern Africa and even beyond to South Africa and Western Australia to train literally thousands and thousands and thousands of people who can go out into wasted places and regreen them. And that's just so powerful, the message that that's starting to send. And I'm working with another Dutch organization called the Weathermakers, and it's the last chapter of my book. And their idea is they would like to regreen the whole Sinai Desert, which at one point they felt thousands of years ago when it was forested and when it was green, it was a climate crucible. It brought moist winds in because of its vegetation from the Indian Ocean during the monsoon seasons and kept the whole region green. And then as the trees were cut down, as the plants were eaten by livestock, and as the weather started becoming more extreme, temperatures and so on, it lost that ability to provide the Eastern Mediterranean and parts of North Africa and east all the way to India with the moisture it needed. And so they're trying to recreate through regreening positive climate changes, hence their name, the Weathermakers. And it's really a very, very powerful enterprise that they're involved in. And I've designed some very quixotic technologies to take salt water and convert it to fresh and convert the fresh water to vegetation in the desert. And so I'm very deeply involved and very much convinced that it can be done. And we do have a precedent. There is a section of China about the size of France. It's called the Los Plateaux. and it was desert, and it had very fine sands in its desert, and the winds would blow them up and blow the sands into the air, and they would flow down towards Beijing and the other major cities of China. And the pollutants that were in the atmosphere from industry and agriculture would catch on to these sands, blowing sands, and really make life difficult, particularly at certain times of year, for people in Beijing and other places. So about 25 years ago, the Chinese set out to re-green the whole Los Plateaux. And you wouldn't think it's possible. But if you go to, if you look up the film Green Gold by John Liu, L-I-U, you will see the story of this almost miraculous transformation of a wasted region to a bountiful region. Almost nobody lived there 25 or 30 years ago. Now I understand that close to 1 million people are living off the new ecology which is formed. So it can be done. It's the one example worldwide where large-scale regreening of a desert-like area has taken place. The film is wonderful. You just gotta, you know, you just gotta look it up. Green
Gold.
I'll get it.
You know, one of the things that our Slow Food chapter does is we do have film screenings, and we show films that are inspirational and, you know, that have to do with environmental health, agriculture.
Yeah, well, you'll,
so I will definitely get it.
You'll like this. It's what when the weather makers talk about the Sinai and other places, they now have that example to tell, you know, government officials or skeptical engineering firms that it can be done. And so it's, as I say, it's the last chapter in my book. Each chapter talks about a different project that I'm involved in somewhere in the world, including the, you know, the development of sailing ships that are designed to clean up literally millions and millions of gallons a day of contaminated seawater in various places around the world.
So exciting. Really exciting.
Lots.
I want to hear more about that, but let's take a couple minute break, and when we come back, let's go right to that, because I'm very interested in that.
Okay.
Everyone, don't go anywhere. I'm talking with Dr. John Todd about some of his inventions and his new book, Healing Earth. Be right back.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll, the founder of the Progressive Radio Network. Today we have more than 80 producers bringing forth the most progressive and most liberating information, the kind of information you do not regularly hear on any of the mainstream or alternative media. You can help us now. Up to this point, I have virtually supported the Progressive Radio Network, all of its expenses and payroll, myself. But we would like to expand our reach. We'd like to do far more. We'd like to be able to advertise on Facebook and let others know we exist. We are the number one progressive radio network in the world. In fact, we have programs that are most listened to in all of progressive radio. But we could go a lot further. Our message could reach a lot more people, especially at a time when people are desperate for honest, objective insights on the important topical issues of our day. How can you help? It's simple. Go to prn.fm, go to our main page. In the upper right-hand corner, you'll see a little button, Support Now. And then whatever you can contribute on a monthly basis. will make a big difference. It will help get the message out. It will help inform more people, give them more choices. This is where you'll hear in the independent candidates and the people looking to challenge the corruption in government and industries. But we need to get our reach out further. So please, whatever you can afford on a monthly basis, and there's some suggestions there, and it'll be automatic. All right, thank you very much for continuing to help us help you and the rest of the world on these important issues.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back. I'm talking with John Todd, author of the book Healing Earth and founder of the field Ecological Design. And I'm just really thrilled with talking with him. And right before the break, we started talking about sailing ships that he has designed that are cleaning up contaminated water. So, John, can you tell us about these wonderful sailing ships?
Well, I have to sort of say up front that the first one has not yet been built, but we hope it is soon.
Oh, okay.
What we've been doing and over the past number of years is working on ways to clean up the inshore oceans. That is the bays, the harbors, the salt ponds, and so on and so forth that ring our coasts and much of the world. And so we've been inventing what we call miniature eco-machines. And these are living technologies. In other words, they're made up of lots of different life forms that we then attach to things like an anchor line for a boat in a harbor, so that all these little technologies which we insert into places where there really is no space for a larger technology. And we've begun to learn how to take very diverse marine life forms, assemble them in these technological forms, and take out nutrients and poisons. And we've done it in a number of different settings in a number of different ways and in a number of different places around the world. But we finally got to the point where we felt we knew enough that we could scale up. And then the BP oil spill happened in the Gulf of Mexico. And I guess it must be 10 years now. I'm not exactly sure. But I was so traumatized by the violence of that oil spill on the oceans that I said, I've got to commit myself to creating a technology that would help clean up the water, not right at the site of the oil spill because that's too toxic, but away a few miles and begin to protect the Gulf of Mexico and other places like that from these onslaughts. And so at that point, I began to design. The vessel had to be fossil fuel free. It had to be powered entirely by photoelectric, solar electric, and wind power. And so that we would design these rigs. These were kind of biggish ships. They were about 130 feet long and 60 feet wide. They were two-hulled vessels, and between the hulls, we would clean up the seawater. And as the idea developed, I then was in touch and started working with a Canadian naval architect, Laurie McGowan, and we began to see how actually able to create these small ships that would be free of fossil fuels and, you know, very beneficial in terms of their carbon footprint on the inshore oceans, which is the opposite of most ships, as you know. Mm-hmm. And we've found after a couple of years that, in fact, it was possible. And now we've reached the stage where we're getting to the point where we can implement these technologies. And the idea is to start with two ships. And but then the Europeans have just asked us if one of the ships, a ship, maybe a third one, could be modified to provide supply the human and the biological materials that are needed for the Sinai project. In other words, to not pollute in order to protect, if you see what I mean. So these ideas are moving ahead now, and I'm actively involved in the fundraising for these two vessels. And one of the, you know, like this, one of the things that when I showed my students the ships and everything else, they said, "John, you're making one big mistake. These ships need to be schools as well." So the current version has on board accommodations for students to, you know, to live on these vessels and work on them and understand the processes and become classrooms or maybe schools. Who knows? But it was the students that kept pushing, use them as teaching tools, not just mm-hmm. to clean up problems, but to show others how to do it and how they can be done in many different ways at many different scales. You know, you could say you live in a little town on the coast and its harbor is polluted. You know, we design supplements to the docks so that each dock becomes we call the technology, we call them eco machines. They clean up the water and they don't block people from coming in and out, ferry boats and things like that. So they're the technology.
So when you say it's cleaning up the water, it's not cleaning up the water from garbage though, right? It's cleaning up the water from contaminants, correct?
Cleaning up the water from contaminants that run in, you know, every time it rains, all the runoff from roads and everything else, and dog poo and you name it, and that can be cleaned up.
Mm-hmm. And how do they work? You said it works modeling natural forms in nature. So
yes,
do you have oysters in there, you know, or
yeah,
you know,
yeah, exactly. We have oysters. We have seaweeds. We have a wide variety. We actually have representative forms of life from all the six kingdoms of life. So that there are plants, there are fungi, there are animals, there are bacteria, the two kinds, the archaebacteria and so on, and then there are the protista, the creatures that are more advanced than, say, bacteria, but not yet formed in the way an animal might be. And they're all represented in these technology. And what happens is that water flows over surfaces. And on these surfaces, are these living forms, including they're called algae turfs, meaning just algae turfs, and they're very productive, and they have well, maybe a dozen species of algae and all the allied forms of life associated with them. And they're constantly digesting and breaking down, say, hydrocarbons in the water, particular contaminants. They're very good at eliminating certain kinds of harmful bacteria. They do all these things, and they work at many different scales. We originally started at a much larger scale, treating sewage inside large greenhouse structures. But this is kind of infill ecological design. The technologies are almost so invisible, but they are working all the time, provided these communities that we attach to the technologies are thriving. And they, in turn, reduce the amount of nitrogen, which reduces the amount of algae overproduction. We have a couple of facilities in California that have taken the toxic algae, which you read about so much these days, and basically reduced them to the point where they're no longer a negative effect on the two lakes involved. So we can do a lot of things. And I think if your listeners would like to find out how they work, what the theory is behind them, I don't think there's any better place to go than the book, the new book, Healing Earth, because it's all in there. And according to reviewers, it's very accessible language that complex ideas are described in a simple kind of language, which makes accessibility to this world of nature possible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's so exciting. Now, if the eco machines are filtering all of these contaminants, is there some sort of filter that then needs to be cleaned out? Are the contaminants contained in something that needs to be strained, or does it just kind of like disappear and keep working indefinitely?
We have a facility that cleans up oil spills in Grafton, Massachusetts, which is along the Bridgestone corridor between Worcester, Mass, and Providence, Rhode Island. And there, the oil, it's a heavy crude oil that is contaminating the canals. It is broken down by our little cluster of technologies there, well over 95%. And that the oils in that case are basically being eaten up into smaller and smaller molecules until they no longer exist as oils. Now, in a situation where we also are dealing with heavy metals, and we've been doing this for many years, then we put a algae-based system at the front end of the process, and it's algae that's growing in very bright light environments. In other words, inside clear tanks, big like pools, but they're clear-sided. And the algae that grows on the walls of those tanks takes the heavy metals and removes them from water. Now, those metals obviously cannot be broken down. They are elemental substances. So we then take the algae and harvest it. These are the algae that are on the walls. And at the same time, we harvest the metals. And then, of course, at that point, the metals have to either be treated in one way or another if they're going to be reused. But what we are doing is removing the metals, thanks to our algae friends, from the wild environment where they can do damage.
Mm-hmm. And then when you harvest metals, what do you, when you say harvest them, I don't really understand this. Does that mean that you can then reuse them?
Well, the answer is, my answer is yes and no. We've certainly made honest attempts to try and find ways of making the metals reusable, but usually they're in such dilute numbers. You know, there, you can do things like acid baths, and you can use fire, but in no time yet have we found a concentration in any of our direct experience which was high enough that metals recovery could be considered an economic option. So basically what we're doing is taking them out of circulation. Of course, one of the things that one can do, and this is another story, I'm digressing, is there are a number of different plants which then can take up the metal and park them in their tissue for, you know, up to hundreds of years. So you're slowing down the movement of the metal is what you're doing. You're not taking it out of the world entirely at all.
So interesting. And it is, you know, it is hopeful. And like, you know, at the beginning of my show today, you know, and I talked about some good news. I mean, we're so bombarded. Like you said, you know, when you were teaching these young people and they're all depressed, I mean, you become paralyzed with all the negative stories we're constantly hearing. And it is just so uplifting to hear some innovative ideas and ways that we can actually turn this thing around. And so with your expertise and your scientific knowledge, do you really think it's possible to turn this climate crisis around?
Well, let me put it, to answer your question in short term, I do think it's possible. I think that the Los Plateau in China is just a crying out example. But the current collapse of, say, the insect populations, which is important for, you know, not only all plant life, but pollinating our food plants, our food crops, that can only be reversed if we stop using large volumes of chemicals on the landscape to manage our agriculture. So if any of your listeners want to make a difference in the world, if they ate only organic foods, and preferably fresh and local, but let's just start with only organic foods, they would begin the process of increasing biodiversity, of including farmers that know how to sequester in their soils through the use of certain kinds of plants to reduce the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, to put it back in the soils where it belongs.
Right.
It's interesting how, and you know this, how so many of the new generation of farmers think of themselves as carbon farmers, as well as food for people farmers.
Right.
And this, I think, is amazing. You can do this in a little kitchen pot in your backyard or front yard. You can plant amongst your lettuces and amongst your, say, tomatoes, rows of warm season perennial grasses, like switchgrass. It belongs to a genus called Panicum. And when you do that, you plant those warm season perennial grasses. They grow year after year, obviously. They're perennials. But they have an extraordinary ability to penetrate deeply into the soils and take atmospheric carbon and convert it into the soil-making process between their roots. So all of us can be involved in learning the techniques. And in the book, there's a chapter on Appalachia, and I talk about literally creating soils on coal mine bedrock after the natural environment had been utterly destroyed by the coal industry.
Yeah, I found that so fascinating.
It really is. There are so many ways, and then in that chapter, what I'm doing is looking at how a institutions on the landscape can change to match the landscape itself. So when you have a plowed field and you leave it alone, it eventually grows weeds, and then eventually diversity of plants, including perennials, and then they become shrubs, and then finally trees, and eventually you have a forest, which ecologists call succession. And what we're beginning to see is that institutions on the landscape need to have their own succession through the various stages, so that a project, like, say, begins with 1,000 acres in West Virginia, for example, could then spread out over 1,000,000 acres by the various
I think what we have to figure out, though, is who's going to make money from this? Because we're in such a capitalist society that, you know, just doing good is not a business venture that people are investing in, unfortunately. And, you know, coal companies that are doing the destruction and the gas companies, they're all, you know, in it for profit. And so there's, you know, there's not profit really to be made in cleaning all the problems up. And I think that's, we have the reality, and we have to figure out how people can make money at it, because that's what drives our economy, unfortunately. But we're just about out of time. So right now, until we figure out who's going to invest in it to make money, it sounds like you could use some people just making some donations to your organization. So maybe you could share with everybody where they can go and maybe donate to some of these great projects you're doing, and we can start there and get everybody reading your book.
Get back, Johnny, briefly, if I have time, to what you just said. If you look at the chapter on the restoring the damaged lands of Appalachia, every element that we put onto the landscape has two functions. One, to heal the landscape, and two, to create economic opportunities.
Right. Well, that's great. But we are out of time. I hear my music coming on, John. So we have to go. I will share your information on my website for everyone. John@toddecological.com. And you can, I'm sure, make donations right there on the website. And John, thank you so much for joining me. It's been wonderful and so mind-opening to hear about the work you're involved in. Thank you so much. And everyone out there listening, thanks for joining us, and have a great rest of the day.